But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Close to 20. Sitting outside today on a freaking beautiful day. Joined by my good buddy, funny comic. Known this guy for, I don't know, close to 10 years now, probably something like that.
Can't believe it's that long.
Yeah, it's Mr. Joe Fernandez.
What's up, Scott?
With an S.
With an S. That's, it's spelt wrong on everything. Even my prescription card for like, prescriptions. I don't know what word I was fishing for there.
Even my prescription card for prescription.
I felt like there was another word. My brain was like clawing for a word, and I'm like, I think I said the word already.
But anyway, Joe, I've been on Joe's podcast, which is, I don't know, Joe's show.
It's on hiatus. I don't know if it's still a podcast.
Yeah, but you got close to 50 episodes up there.
Yeah, something like that. I'm considering that maybe like season one. I had to take a break for personal reasons, but maybe we'll start season two up again soon.
Yeah. He does another great podcast. I suggest you check it out. It's just I Don't Know Joe, right?
Yeah, I Don't Know Joe show. You go to my website or you search out on iTunes, on Stitcher Radio. A lot of the episodes are pretty like evergreen, so it's not like too topical.
Right.
So you can go listen to anyone and check it out.
Yeah, and I think I was on, I don't know, I think I was on the maybe 4 or 5 ago, something like that.
I don't know, man.
I don't remember. It's
quite
a while. But anyway, Joe, you, like I said, I've known you for a while. I knew you when I was first interning and then working kind of part-time at the TV station.
Yeah.
And at that time you were into comedy, but I guess you were just starting to get a little momentum when I first met you.
Well, not momentum. I was 10 years ago. I was just starting.
Right.
I'm like just started my 10th year.
10th
of,
year.
Of comedy.
So what age did you start at? What was like the first time you went out and decided I'm going to try give this a shot?
Well, I guess it was 03 or 04. I always forget. I have to always look at this. I have a tape of it, like an audio cassette recording of it. That's how long ago. It's an actual audio cassette. So it was either 03 or 04. I did a convention. I was involved with this convention for years before I was a comedian that I used to help get entertainment for.
Right.
And we used to always use this comedian, Mike DiStefano. And I became a little bit of friends with him from booking him at that over the years. And people always told me you should try it. So I just asked if I can MC the comedy show to try comedy. So I tried comedy for the first time in front of 300 people.
So you MC'd first, too? Like, right off the
MC'd bat? First time ever on stage doing stand-up comedy, I MC'd in front of 350 people.
That's awesome.
It was frightening
at the same time.
Frightening.
But
it went okay, but, you know, the thing is, I'm at a convention that I've been involved in for years, so it was, like, I knew a big percentage of the crowd. So I think I got more love than I would normally get.
Right.
You know?
Almost like when you have family present. You know, they'll laugh just to laugh.
So then I went out into the real world the following week and realized how really bad I sucked. But it was addicting, you know?
Oh, yeah. So you, when did you, you started comedy, and you were basically just people telling you to do it. Were you interested in it before that, or was it more like people said, hey, you should try it, and then it kind of planted the seed in your mind?
For years, people used to tell me I should try it, but I don't know. I never saw bad comedy for years. Like, whenever I went and saw comedy, It was always like, oh, I'm going to go see Richard Jenny. I bought tickets. I'm going to go see Chris Rock. You pay to see the best comedians, so you watch the best comedians, and you're like, I can't be that.
Right.
You know, Robert Schimmel I used to go see, and you're like, yeah, I don't know. I think when you see mediocre comedy, and you're like, I could do that. I can stink.
Well, like, we were just talking right before we started recording, like, you know, I'm pretty much brand new at this, couple months in, did it a little bit back in college or right out of college, and, you know, it almost makes me feel good to see how many bad comics there are, how many, like, people who said they've been in it for 10 years doing mics, and they're just, you know, either, one, I hear them do the same thing over and over again, or two, I find that a lot of comics hide behind just trying to be dirty, and they're not getting laughs for the jokes, they're getting laughs for either cursing or saying something absolutely absurd. And it's almost like sometimes it makes the audience feel uncomfortable and they laugh. It's not really, they're not buying into his material. It's just like, oh my God. Like,
yeah.
I find that a lot. Like, a lot of people just try to go for that shock.
Yeah, you'll find that a lot at open mics. I mean, you know, I remember early on, I forget his name. I used to go to the Stress Factory on Wednesday nights for the open mic when I first started. And there was this, I think he was like a homeless guy or something. I don't know. Like, but he had some weird name for like some outer space name or something. And like, it was awful, yeah. But you just had to watch him because it was going to be the most insane thing you've ever heard. But like, open mics is where you see like the craziest of crazy sometimes. But like, yeah, I mean, you know, people all suck at the beginning. It's whether you start hanging around people that'll give it to you honest. Like, I have a lot of good friends right. that are honest with me and kind of push me in a better way.
Right. So when you started going out, you started playing, you started, I guess, you said you did your first first mic in front of 300 people. Where did it go from there? Was it like first time hooked, or was it like,
Well, I had a good time that night, and then I remember going home and looking for an open mic. Because I remember open mic when I was a musician, when I was in my teens and early 20s, I used to go to a lot of open mics. Seek that open mic. I found that the Stress Factory had one and was going there. And went there on a Wednesday. Like, honestly, like, I never thought I was going to do I never thought I'd get paid to do comedy. It was like, I always was writing, you knew that,
hobby.
Making my short films. And I just would go out on Wednesday with, like, a pad full of jokes. And if I bombed, I bombed. If I did okay, I did okay. But I always found it was fun. I liked the people. I met, like, Joe Conte
right.
there, and it just kind of, like, I don't even know. Like, it just kind of snowballed. Like, I never even thought of it as anything. I just was having fun with it, and then, you know, people said, hey, you want $50 to MC my show? And I'm like, yeah.
Yes, I do.
And I couldn't believe, and then when I got that first 50, I was like, wow, that was the greatest money I ever made.
Yeah, I mean, doing something you love, and that's completely yours.
And I didn't even do that well, and they paid me anyway, which
right.
was great.
But I think that's the thing I'm finding that I love, that everything I do is completely my fault, but it's also completely mine. You know what I mean? Like, if I bomb, it's okay, because I could take that as motivation, like, what didn't work, or why didn't that work, instead of just being like, I fucking bombed, this sucks, you know? Like, everyone bombs, like...
Right. You learn nothing from killing. I forget who said it, but somebody said that. Some famous comic said, when you bomb, you have data to work with. And then you have, like, all this stuff to work with. But when you kill, you're like, it all works. So you really learn nothing from killing. You know? It's great because you feel... I mean, you get, like a point, like, wow, it finally came together how I wanted it to.
Yeah. You know? Like, bombing, like, I almost, like... The times I've bombed, it's like I go home in the car, and it's the first thing on my mind. Like, I want to get home and listen back to my... Because I record just about everything.
Yeah.
Listen back, like, why didn't that work? Or go right back through my material. Like, I'm almost more awake and
sad.
And sad.
Yeah.
And sad, but, like, I want to get right back to it. You know, like, okay, let's take a look at this again. Why didn't it work? Was it just me that night? Did this material suck? You know, like...
That's how you know people... I mean, I knew a lot of funny comedians, you know, for the time, for open mic funny, back when we started, that were, like, the funniest guys, but bombing they couldn't handle. And I feel like the sicker you are, the more you stick with it, because you're just like, I equate it to drug addiction, because it's like, I remember, like, we do drugs, you're like, especially do a drug you really like, you're like, oh my God, this is the best feeling I've ever had. I want to do this for the rest of my life.
Right.
And then you have a bad night on that drug and you're like, I'm never going to do this again. And then you're like, you know what? Let me try it one more time, because you remember that time it worked. And then that's a cycle of drug addiction where you're chasing that first time. I find that to be like comedy. Like, you know, same type of thing. You're like, oh, I know this worked one time for me.
Right.
So
why did this work? Like, what is there funny in this? Like, but so a lot of your material focuses around your personal demons, correct? Or addiction?
Yeah. It always finds its way back to that. I always try to steer myself away. Because when I first started, it was all about drug addiction, like my whole act.
Right.
And then, like, I remember this club owner one time said, I like it, but I think sometimes you may be a little too dark to be the opener. it's like to start off the show on, like, it's funny, but it's almost like it's a little
depressing.
Much. So I was like, yeah, maybe I gotta find a more fun loving way to do this, or maybe try and
right now
I always explore back to it, because for some reason I can take the healthiest thing in the world and turn it into a negative addiction for me. Like, where a doctor's like, you should really stop doing this.
Right. Now, I haven't seen your act in quite a long time. That's why I know, like, I remember a lot of your addiction material. But I know you got clean, what, pretty young age, right?
10 days before my 20th birthday. I was, like, 19, going to be 20.
That's like Jim Norton.
Second time I got clean. First time was in high school. Very hard to stay clean in high school.
But that's amazing for you to almost realize that at that young of an age and stick to this day. Like, you know, it seems like a lot of people, like, during their 20s, that's when they start to do, you know, fall further in and really experiment. And it's, not only that, you turn 21 and booze is everywhere. It's amazing.
So I was always ahead of the curve drug-wise of my peers. Like, you know. Me and my friends were doing...
You were a drug honor student.
Yeah, like, I remember, like, I was, like, 16, like, 17 years old, and, like, with a girl, and we're like, you want to do blow? And she's like, what? And I'm like, oh, you don't? Like, because everyone in my world did.
Right.
Like, my friend's world, so you just assume other people do.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, wow, I should probably not be as open and honest with new girls about this. But no, I mean, yeah, I guess I'm... You know, for lack of a better term, blessed that I did at such a young age. I don't know why. I have friends that didn't get it and are dead.
Yeah.
One recently.
Yeah, I just saw you post that. It's crazy. It's crazy. I think that's part of my personality, why I really stayed away from drugs my whole life, because I know my personality. I get addicted to anything and quickly.
Yeah.
Like, I make my own beer. Like, as soon as I started doing that, it was like, I got to get everything possible and do it as much as possible.
Yeah.
It's just anything. Is it music? Like, I got to get this pedal. I want a new bass. Like, it's just always been like that. And I know, like, myself, like, I feel like if I tried blow or something like that, it'd be instantly grab me.
Right. And there's people that do it. I had a friend that used to do just as much as we did, and one day it's like, nah, I'm going to stop and get a job and become responsible. You're like, wow, you were able to do that. You don't know you're an addict. I always hear people, like, you know, I meet a lot of young kids that struggle with getting clean, and their parents are like, a lot of parents, like, take credit. Like, if my kid wasn't a drug addict, I was a good parent. It's like, it really had nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
I was like, because I always tell people I have good parents.
Right.
And that's like, I did what every other kid did. Try weed, try boo. I just loved it more than the average kid. I mean, I didn't know I was going to. I didn't know.
Yeah. So, like, your material today, what kind of drives you now? Like, you say you're kind of trying to get away, but keep bringing it back.
Well, because now it's food addiction. It's like I said, I don't do drugs no more, but now, like, because, like, what you learn when you're, getting clean is, it's not even about drugs.
Right.
That's just like the symptom of the disease of addiction. It's like I have like this hole in me that I try to fill with stuff.
Like,
so it's like, all right, we got rid of the drugs, and for a while after drugs it was girls. You know what I mean? You're like, I'm just gonna try and have as much sex as I possibly could.
Right.
To, like, not, so I don't have to think. Like, that's really...
It's like filling a void.
Filling
like,
a void. Like, and then and now, you know, I'm older and married, so you can't do drugs, can't go around looking for girls. So now, what do?
Well, you could.
Cookies.
But it wouldn't last very long.
Right, cookies. Yeah, you're married. Yeah, you could. I conceivably could, but I prefer... I have a great wife. I don't want to ruin that, so I fill the hole with Entenmann's cakes and ice cream. But then that got out of hand because I had ballooned up and I just recently lost 10 pounds because I was like, and it's just like, I've come to accept it. And you know what? It's fine. But you know what? The difference now, I talk about addiction in my act. I don't even really talk about drugs in my act. It's now about food.
Right.
And my obsession with food. And people relate with that. So I'm like finding, I'm still talking about addiction, but people... You know, so now if I'm talking about with food, then tell them I'm on drugs, it's more like, oh, it's more interesting than coming out with crack stories, like after, like, like, please welcome your opener, Joe Fernandez. And
it's kind of interesting because you're
where all my crackheads at?
You're still talking about, you know, addiction. It's kind of interesting because it, you know, it shows that it's not just a drug. It's more of a, almost like your personality. Something in you, right?
Right.
Like you're saying the void or the hole, or it's something that you're always trying to fill with something.
Yes.
In a way.
It's a day-to-day struggle. Like I was talking to somebody recently, we're talking about confidence in our career paths and performing. And like early on in my comedy career, I had a really good tape. Like I caught a brilliant night of me performing.
Right.
And I used that and I got an audition for a Comedy Central Live at Gotham
really?
From it. But I wasn't ready for it because I was an anomaly that night. That night was a miracle.
You're on fire.
So they booked me for this audition night based on that tape, and I ate my balls because I wasn't ready. And it really kind of, I was like, I'm not going for anything until I know I'm ready.
Now, where'd you have to go audition for that? Like, in
was
front
it,
of a couple people? Or
no,
like
was at the Laugh Lounge. The club's not around no more. It was Laugh Lounge in Manhattan. There was like 10 of us on the showcase. And, you know, executives, cameras, wow. They were filming. And I got nervous because I wasn't seasoned enough to know how to... Like, I just went up there like it was like... a regular show.
And this was very
early. As soon as I got in, very early. I'm in my first, like, I was, like, doing, like, a year and a half, which is really early in comedy.
So that has to almost trick you, like, holy, like, you know, I'm like.
Well, the moment I got there and I saw the cameras and the people, I got really, I mean, I'm talking, like, borderline having an anxiety attack, nervous. And it was because I wasn't ready for it. I'm now, but, like, everyone else on the showcase was seasoned and had, like, and I ate it, man. And I'm like, ugh.
But
so,
did that, like, almost like having, you know, whatever you want to call it, a break or close to a break, like, so early on, does that almost trick you for a little bit? Like, oh, my God, I'm like, I must be great. This is coming so fast. This isn't hard.
Well, not really, because it was so fleeting that I didn't have time to feel great about it.
Right.
I felt great when I got the email that I had it. And then it really got dashed a few weeks later. But what I was getting to is that now I'm in between my 9th and 10th year. And, like, I still remember that like it was yesterday. But I always feel like it'll never get as worse as that night. That was, like, a really – like, the only way you can bomb harder than that night is if they, like, literally lit the place on fire afterwards. Like, there's – and wouldn't let you out.
Do you have that, like
– the video? Tape? No, I'd never want to see that.
No,
it's – I gain nothing. Listen, it is my most vivid memory of comedy.
All right, sorry, we just had to stop tape there for a second. I filled up on memory. But, Joe, we were just talking about your experience with the auditioning for the Gotham, you said?
It was Live at Gotham back then, yeah.
Right.
No, yeah, it bombed. It was miserable. But I think my original point was I was trying to make was back then that, you know, I went for something I wasn't ready for. I got it based on a good tape, but... it kind of made me – I was so depressed after that I said I'm not going to go for anything till I know what I'm doing.
Right. So you kind of like reset almost.
I reset. I was like, I just got to go out and learn how to become a comedian. I got to learn how to, you know, have some – it's so weird because like you get laughs on stage, but are you feeling good up there? It takes so many years to feel good up there. And even in this time, I had an I did a TV taping. I got involved in. I got flown out to Pittsburgh to do a. They're trying to do a show with recovering people.
Right.
And I got my buddy Mike Gaffney on the show with me. It was me, Mike, my friend Billy Robinson, and this comedian Raj G. And that was now we're in this theater, and I was in it was the craziest thing. They had this beautiful theater. And like they had like a sheet up, kind of like how Aerosmith drops the sheet down to like, and like that's how it was like presented to this crowd. So like I'm already like I'm like okay, I'm a few years in now, but you always have to do something to make me like uncomfortable and not what I normally do. You know, so it's like a sheet drops and I'm in this big theater
away from smoke machines,
crane arms, and
oh wow.
But it did good, but the show didn't get picked up. But whatever, it was an experience. You know what I mean? But the difference there was. I was just kind of performing, and somebody saw me and offered it to me. So it was, I feel like I earned it, like off a live performance instead of this amazing tape I had. Like it was like a couple of years in, but like I was talking recently, I was out with my buddy, and we were talking about confidence in comedy, and I was like, you know, back then I had a lot of confidence and no skill, and then now I started getting the skill, and now I have that. Eating me back from the past, it's like hitting my confidence,
right?
And I was like, I just come to realize like what addiction is like. It's a day-to-day thing with me, man.
Right.
It's just something I got to keep in check, you know.
Now, do you ever get like you ever get to a point where you almost feel like,
did that, any of that make sense? I don't even know.
Kind of.
I had a point originally before your tape stopped, and I couldn't get back to it.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when the tape stops.
People are like, what the fuck is he talking about?
But I mean, like, do you ever get to a point where, like, you hate your material, like...
Exclusively, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
like, when you're writing it, it's great. You perform it, it's great. But, like, something about it, you just don't like it. Like, is that, like, a self-deprecating thing? Or is that, like, where you gotta shake yourself out of it and just believe in yourself and kind of, you know, suppress those feelings a little bit? Like, because I've talked to people, and sometimes they get in a rut, but their material's great. Like, I'll see them perform, and they're like, eh. Like, they just never seem happy with it.
You know, that's weird. I mean, if I'm doing a joke, if I'm doing stuff for a long time, sometimes it just stops working, because I think you're bored of saying it, and I think the crowd realizes he don't even look like he's enjoying telling this joke. Why should we enjoy listening to this joke?
That's it.
But I'm always tinkering. I try to always, I try to bring something new to every show, whether it's a tag or a new idea,
right?
To keep it
fresh,
keep me interested. You know.
Well, it's funny you say that. I'm not going to mention it. Like when I got to open down in Ocean City a couple weeks ago, the headliner, not Johnny, but the headliner, he was just, you could tell the joy of comedy has been sucked from his soul.
Just mailing it in.
And just mailing it in, just hundreds of pounds overweight, just miserable, you know, like can barely get on stage, just sitting in a chair.
Does his name start with a D?
It does.
I know what you're talking
about. And just delivering... Kind of hacky, kind of just like you could tell that material he's probably had it for 20 years. That's what it seemed like to me. And I've never even heard the guy.
Yeah.
That's what it seemed like to me. And it was almost sad. Like, it's almost sad. I'm like, you know, I don't want to be like that.
Well, that's why I mean, like, the friends I surround myself with, we're, I don't know, we've kind of even asked each other, like, don't let it, we're not going to let each other be that. We're going to always try and push each other or make fun of each other if we see them, somebody like slacking off and. And tease each other because it's like, because it's so easy when shit starts working to just keep doing it.
It's become stagnant.
Like there was, you know, because like me and my friends always talk about this. There was like, okay, I just started closing shows. Just started,
right?
Like people are starting to ask me to do like 45 minutes. So it's a whole new thing I'm learning. You know what I mean? It's just as nerve wracking as middling for the first time. It's more nerve-wracking because now you're the end. Like, you got to bring it home. And when you – there's no way to learn to do that without doing it. Like, I can't – it's more than just, I'm just going to add 15 minutes to what I normally do. It's like, you know, it's a whole mindset
right.
And like – and I forgot the fuck what I was – my mind is not working today. But
I know what you're saying. I would imagine anyway. It's like learning about pacing and setting up your stuff in the right order and
But what we were talking about was like being stagnant. Right. You always got to keep trying for more. Even in and me and my friends do that to each other. We like pressure each other. Like I James, the guy who runs the comedy shop, has been telling me he wants me to close shows for a while, and I'm like, nah, I'm not ready.
Right.
And he's like, why do you think that? I'm like, because I just, you know, it's that whole thing in the past. Like, I don't want to go for it.
But I guess once you leap over that wall, which you say you kind of are now, you're closing.
I'm starting to. Like, I did a few, and it went, you know, it went good. You know, one went really good, and a few went good. But I'm learning. I'm learning. I'm hitting that muscle. It's like weightlifting. It's like you can't sit home and figure it out.
I would imagine some of that has to be like also like a mindset. You have to say to yourself, I am good enough to be here. I'm, you know.
Right. I've if you don't think you're good enough, right, you're not going to do
I've worked hard. I am, you know, I keep up on my craft. Like, I imagine that that's a hard thing, you know, for a lot of people. Like, oh, you beat yourself down sometimes too. I mean, there's two sides to it. There's people who are not ready and think they are. And then I'm guessing there's people like you who I imagine you're ready. Like, I've seen your stuff. I've heard your stuff. You've been around. You've been traveling like for years now. I would imagine that you're close, if not ready to take that next step.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's nervous every time you do. It's like, you know, when I went from open mic and some guy goes, yo, you want to come on a real show, $50 to MC, you, first you're excited, then you get there, you're like, holy shit, these are like real people, and it's a full crowd. I've never done this. It's so nerve-wracking.
It was funny, like, you know, I'm so new, and I got asked to do that. I texted you the other day. I got asked to do that project graduation, and I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. And then I'm like, you know, before this, they're like, don't talk about this. I'm like, you know, right before the show, my mind goes blank for a minute, and I'm like,
that sucks for everybody.
Yeah, but actually, it turned out to be, you know, I just kind of let it go and realized the kids were 18 years old and they are adults. And they, you know, like, and it actually turned out great. And it was fun working with, I got to work with Joe Conti.
Yeah.
And
I bombed the project graduation. I get there, they go, don't talk about drugs and sex. I go, you got any bongos I can play? I don't know what I'm going to do.
But it was great. The kids loved it. I mean, I went on before Joe, and he actually told me, he's like, I'm glad you let some of it go, because he went on, and you know how he is. He's aggressive and loud, and he can...
Oh, he don't care about the rules.
No.
That was annoying. I did a show with him, Project Graduation, where I stayed in the rules, ate my balls. Joe goes up, cursing, sex, everything, killing. And I'm like, why did I listen to the fucking adults here? I should have just performed to the kids what I do.
But that was a really fun experience for me, being so young, and it was great just even being placed in front of a couple hundred people. I guess it was probably like 200 kids or something like that, and just going, you know, from my normal couple people in the crowd to actually having like a, you know, it was fun. It was a great learning experience, which I wanted to get to was what's the weirdest places you've played, and what are some of the best you can remember? Like, for me, being so new, the weirdest place I played was a pizza shop, and it was called like Anthony's Pizza and Pasta in Morristown. I'm like, there's no way it's a pizzeria, and I get there, and sure enough, it's eight old guys playing Bob Dylan songs to each other, and I called the guy before. I'm like, you do comedy? He's like, yeah, and it's in the middle of a pizzeria, like, but you know what? I was there, and I said, all right, I'm going to do it. And it actually turned out to be fun. They were like, oh, this is cool. We never get to hear comedy, and, like, we liked it, and it's a change of pace. And then they went back to playing, like, a Rolling Stone right after that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you've played some – you've had to play some weird places in your day.
Yeah, pizza places. I played a few pizza places. I've trying to think the weirdest place. I played a basement of a house in New Brunswick one time, like a frat – house basement.
Like a punk rock show, but like comedy?
Yeah, but it wasn't as exciting as a punk rock show. It was like about 12 kids hitting a bong on like a couch they got like probably from a garbage. And we had like a light a guy would use to work on a car like 5 feet from our face. And no microphone, but
no microphone.
No, but it was very. Hey, man, this was. We're talking like the first 6 months of comedy, so you're like, I got a gig on a Saturday. This is great.
I'm starting to learn no matter what, even if there's two people in the crowd, it's still getting up and flushing material out, and there's still something you can take from almost anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, workout. I mean, in the past year, I went. I don't want to say the place because I still get booked there.
Yep.
But I get to a place that's a back room of this restaurant, and I show up. There's 10 people seated about 40 feet from the stage, and they have these big tubes of beer that kind of block their vision of the stage, like
those big self-serve. Like,
it's like a big self-serve tube thing, like set, so like on. So they have to like look around it to see me. So, but I get there, and the restaurant owner or whatever goes, "There's the microphone in the corner. Start whenever you're ready." And it's like tangled in a knot that, like, even when you untangle it, as you're using it, it starts retangling itself, like looping on itself. Yeah. And I'm
so
like,
hardcore. That's 30 years old.
There's nothing that takes your mojo away more than untangling a cord and then starting the show. Like you're sitting there, like, oh wait, just go through this loop or this loop, but then you go, "How's everybody doing?" After just watched you be the AV guy for 10 minutes, it's. But I got $200, so.
Yeah, if you didn't take anything from it, at least you got paid to do it.
That's what I say in my head when I'm eating my balls on a stage. You're like, there was no way this was going to be good anyway. And at least we're getting paid.
Yeah. Now you've been lucky enough to travel now too a couple times, right, to some pretty cool places. Didn't you go to Alaska recently?
Yeah, in the past few years I've been fortunate enough to travel Alaska. I just went out to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was pretty nice. Got to go see a Detroit Tigers game. I tried it. Yeah, I mean, who knows? It's fun whenever you get it. I took Alaska for shit money just to go see Alaska.
Yeah, I went there on my honeymoon. It's amazing.
But, yeah, that's what we do. Travel around. And what, do you have a bug on you or something?
No, I was actually looking for that water.
Oh, it's right behind here. No, yeah, man. No, I travel to mostly non-glamorous places, but occasionally I mean, even Missouri was beautiful, but a lot of times when you're a nobody, you never go out, like, in prime season to, like, a city. It's always like,
right.
Like, we're in Missouri when it's, like, frozen, and, you know, you land in, like, an airport that looks like a public library. You're like, oh, my God, it's awful. You get picked up by some weird crackhead. Like, you can always, like, when you're, like, at a level like I am, you can always pick out the person picking you up. It's like, which one looks like the biggest criminal? And you're like, that's our ride.
The guy that gave $20 to pick you up.
Oh, yeah. We did one. We went to Toronto. And we see the guy. He looks like a James Bond villain. He had, like, greased back hair. Brings us into this, like, Mercedes. And he's like, he has, like, the French accent. He's like, I don't even know how to do a French accent. I just did a Russian one or something.
Anyway.
I don't know. Whatever. I don't do accents. But he had the accent, and he puts us in the car, and he goes to walk around, and I go, dude, if I see a gun with a silencer pop out right now, we get into a high-speed chase, I would not be surprised.
He tosses his hat at you.
Like, oh, no, we go pick up. He goes, I have to go pick up my friend on the way. We go into, like, this weird ghetto area and pick up his crackhead friend who's, like, 4 hours clean. And I'm like, ah, this is the life. This is comedy, baby.
Yep.
This is
So, like, I don't want to talk about just comedy the whole time, but last couple things here. Your biggest influences, if you had to name, maybe let's go top three. You know, if you miss someone, it's not a big deal, but your influences, comedians, they could be dead, they could be working now.
Well, you know, I got to say, my first time I got into comedy as a kid was Eddie Murphy.
Yep.
I mean, Eddie Murphy, like, I know a lot of people say, like, Richard Pryor, which as an adult, I've grown to love Richard Pryor. But as a kid, I had Eddie Murphy cassette tapes. He was just the funniest guy ever.
I had Delirious on tape and played it side to side over and over again.
Yeah, he was, like, my Richard Pryor. Like, some people say they grew up with Richard Pryor. Like, Eddie Murphy was mine. And as, like, as I got older, the stand-ups I used to pay to go see were Richard Jenny and Robert Schimmel.
Right.
I love Robert Schimmel because he was dirty, but he was able to do dirty in a way that everyone loved it.
Dirty but clever.
Like he had this great clip There's this Showtime series where they interview comedians that's been on recently.
Right. What the hell is it called?
I forget.
Yeah, I know. I watch it occasionally, too.
But he was on, and he's talked about how people say, like, being dirty. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, what he said. Being dirty, people say, is the easy way. But he's like, he thinks just the opposite. He's like, if you can get a whole room of people to laugh at something they normally wouldn't laugh at.
Right.
I think that's a tough thing to do. It's like, you can do the safe, clean comedy that everyone's going to accept, but to do something dirty and have, like when I used to see Patrice O'Neill, who I hold in, like,
God.
I mean, I saw him do a gig. I show up just to watch because my friend was booking the gig. So he's like, yeah, come watch the show if you want. And I walk in, and it looks like a fundraiser for, like, the Key Club.
Yep.
It was like, I mean, it was like a bunch of old people. Like, there was no way they were coming out to see comedy that night.
Right.
Not necessarily Patrice. And the way he made these old people laugh at, like, the dirtiest stuff was brilliant to me.
He was just a slayer, man. Like, I have been, the last 2 weeks, just going back, and I don't know. He's, like, my comedian of the month. Like, I've just been watching everything I could find on him. Like, going back to, like, I've been watching Tough Crowd reruns over and over again because I just missed that show so much. I remember, like, that's what I used to go to bed. Like, put that on, go to bed. But it's funny, even just watching the old episodes, they hold up the test of time. They're still hilarious. But I'll just skip to the ones that have Patrice in it. I'm like, no Patrice in this one. Let's go to the next episode. It's just amazing how honest he became and how he made things. He made things look like he didn't have material. Like, he was just.
Well, that, I mean, I look at Patrice I study what he does to see how you can, like, have that fluidity and make it like it's coming off the top of your head. Mm-hmm. That jazz style. I look at Robert Schimmel to show, like, man, you could be dirty and, like, make it universal. And, like I said, Richard Jenny, how to perform and use the stage. And then if I think about it in that level, you look at Eddie Murphy, he did all of that.
Yep. Yep.
He used the stage. He made it fluid. He was edgy.
He was physical. He was everything. You know?
I don't know if he could be that again ever if he went and did comedy again. But
I think that's what keeps him back. Like.
And he was 21 years old. If you think about, or like 20, he was so young. If you think about, like, you look at
think about you when you were 21.
I could never. I'm 39 doing it for 9 years, and I.
No, but I just mean even, like, your mentality at 21, and, like, you're still a kid, you know? Like,
well, he just was, like, a savant, you know, kind of like. I mean, I hear, you read interviews about people that were around Dave Chappelle when he was coming up. How he was just, like. I mean, you could see it. I see it. You see people that you're just, like, they just have it. Well, you can't explain it.
Well, I was talking to Chips the other day, and he was telling me a story about how he saw Chris Rock when he was 18 years old, and he said that kid was brilliant. Like, the minute he saw him on stage, he knew he had something, like, right away. And he was 18, and Chips was, like, telling me about it. I went up to him, and he's like, I love your stuff. And he said 5 years later, he was fucking Chris Rock, you know, like, amazing.
Yeah, well, some people just have this charisma, this thing that you can't manufacture. You know, that's just like my buddy Mike Gaffney, who I do a lot of work with. We hang out, you know, all the time.
Last Comic Standing.
He was on Last Comic Standing. He killed it. But, like, he's just got, there's, like, you know, you can write jokes, you could be funny, you could get laughs, but there's this extra thing that you can't
teach.
You can't manufacture.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen him, like, do, like, mediocre, but they're still loving him.
Yeah.
It's like he's just got, you know.
Oh, he's really funny.
Yeah.
He's really okay. If you were to describe your style to someone that's listening to my podcast, all 20 people, and they wanted to come see you or check you out, what would you say your style is?
I don't even know.
You don't know.
I don't know what styles are. Like, I'm not real dirty. I'm not real clean. I'm,
somewhere in the middle.
Probably why I'm not successful. It's a weird question because I don't even know like what a style term is.
Would you say you're more of a storyteller? Are you? I know that you're not like a one-liner kind of guy. Are you more you try to be very personal on stage.
Definitely personal, but like, you know, it's like you're personal, but it's like, you know, manufactured a little bit, you know, because not everyone's life is that exciting.
No.
It, I guess I kind of do a little bit of everything. I don't know. I'm like I said, I tell people sometimes, you know, I'm between my 9th and 10th year. I feel like I'm just starting to understand what I'm doing. I feel like it took me this long to get like really comfortable on stage, where I feel like I'm just starting to, you know, like you have your funny, like when before you're a comedian, you're funny with your friends at a diner, you're funny, and then you get on stage and you're like, I can't, you're not that funny because you just don't, you're so uncomfortable. Because like when you're with your friends, there's no stakes and you just be who you are.
Right.
I feel like it's, I'm just now starting to be comfortable enough on stage where I, like if something comes in my head that I didn't normally say before, I'm comfortable spitting it out, whether it bombs or not.
Right.
And I think my style is starting to form now.
Nice.
You know what I mean? Like it's really starting to take shape because I feel like for a while I was kind of acting as a comedian in order to get comfortable on stage. Like, I don't even know if that makes any kind of sense. Like,
100%.
Because there's no way to get comfortable without doing it. But, like, I used to, you know, I it's so weird to explain. You don't know until you're in it. Like, I'm just more comfortable now than I ever been, which makes me, like, all the newer stuff that I've happened to be start writing in, like, the past 6 months has been my favorite stuff. Because I feel like it's my most authentic.
Right.
Because sometimes, like, I'll start doing this newer stuff, like, say, like, this new 5-minute chunk. And it's more exciting to me than this previous 30 minutes that I've been dragging along with me for the past 8 years.
Right.
You know, if that makes sense.
Last two questions, comedy questions. How do you prefer to write when you sit down and write? Are you a pen to pad kind of guy? Are you a record your voice and just kind of work it out? Are you a typing? Like, what's your... your preferred writing style, or do you do it all different ways?
I tend to do it all different ways. I guess the most I do is if I have some sort of anything, I write down like a word or something in my notepad on my phone, or sometimes I have a little pad on me. A lot of times I'll call like one of my friends and say like, yo, I had this idea for this bit, and then I'll like say it, and then sometimes they'll laugh and be like, yeah, that's good, and then I'll try and I rarely write it out. I'm starting to write it out only because I want to work on a CD. I want to work on a headline set that's tight. Not necessarily a CD. It's like I don't want to meander.
Right.
So, like, I'm starting to listen to my bits and write them out and see where I can pull words out. I want it tight. You know what I mean? So I used to never really write down. I'm just starting to a little bit only for editing. But I would never – I don't think I write down a brand new joke. I'm writing down some old jokes that I'm like, yeah, I think it's a good joke, but it'd probably be better if I could pull some shit out of it.
Yeah, like me, like I'm being so new at it, I'm finding the hardest – I've been writing it out like a book, and then I'm finding it hard to – I almost go on the stage sometimes and I feel like I'm like – I'm reading it like a narrative sometimes. Like, I'm almost reading
that's
it. I
want to
get away from that so bad. Like, almost more natural delivery. And that's where I'm freezing. I'll be like, that didn't come next. And then I got to be like, you know, it's not a big deal. Tell the story rather than memorize a speech, you know? That's what I'm struggling with right now.
Yeah, try and go up there and just remember it.
Yeah.
Like, I stopped doing set lists for a while because I used to find myself staying hard to that list I put of 10, say like I had like 10 jokes I wanted to do. I became a robot.
Right.
So now I was like, I'm not doing a set list. I've done these jokes a million times. I'm going to go up there. Even if I do that list how I thought of it, I could meander from it. I'm trying to train my brain to like be natural. I feel like the most I can get to be in the natural me, and that's like not putting lists, but like, you know.
Right. That's by far what I'm finding the hardest thing is I'll be like, I'll forget a line, and then I'll be like, you know, like for a second be like lost in space. Like, oh yeah, you know, and then come back.
But you're so early on. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, there's no, like, you know, I used to do this show where, like, afterwards the booker would be, like, there was, like, a lot of newer comics. I'd give them advice, and it's like, I just feel like people, you just got to find your way on stage.
That was actually my next question for you is, advice to young comedians, if you can give, I don't know, 2 or 3 points, like, advice for them, not necessarily well, me,
I'll give
but
advice
any young
that not that people gave to me that I felt worked. So I didn't come up with this. This
right.
is stuff people told me. It's just you just got to get up as much as possible, and that's the only way you get comfortable. It's you just got to work.
Yep.
There's like everyone wants to figure out a way to get there faster, but it's a long haul. And you'll see people drop off because they're like they're not getting the success they want, and I never expected success.
Right.
So if I don't get it, which is probably the track record I'm on, to not get it, but
see, but
not that you shouldn't expect success, but it's like just worry about getting good because I've seen people get to, if you get good.
But it's funny you say that, like success. Like to me, looking at you, I consider you. Successful, maybe not. Of course,
where you're at,
any level, there's 10 levels above you, 10 levels below, whatever. But I see you. You're making money. You're
right.
You're traveling. You're doing what you love, and what you work at.
I never thought I'd be where I'm at, even though it's not really anywhere.
Right? Are you selling out arenas? Of course not. But are you making money as a comedian? Yeah. And you've met people through it. You've traveled through it. You know,
yes.
When you're 7 years old and you look back, hey, I did comedy for a living. I made money. I had great time. And like, of course you got years and years and years to go. But like me looking at you, I go, hey, I would like to do that, you know, be able to do that.
Yeah. You always need a next goal. Mm-hmm. Like early on, I met Otto Peterson from Otto and George fame.
Yep.
God rest his soul. He told me to MC a lot. And,
first time I saw you was with Otto.
Yeah, and he told me to MC a lot.
88 keys.
He said no. He said you MC a lot because nobody wants to MC. So you'll get a lot of work if you say I'm willing to MC. And he told me I'd become a better comic if I MC because you're going to get used to doing well. You're used to working cold crowds. You know,
yeah.
And by the time you start middling, like you're going to be like, and it was, and I became the best MC. I made it a goal to become the best MC. And then my next goal is now I want a middle, da 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 da. And then shit just snowballs. You just always, yeah, like right now, like I'm at the level I'm at now. Now I want a little more.
Of course,
you start getting a little things, but like, there's no like advice. I mean, you got to go up and do whatever you think's funny.
Of course,
don't do what you think the crowd thinks is funny. Do what comes what you think's funny. Some other advice I got was stop. Don't pay attention to what other people are doing. You'll see a lot of comics become shit talkers, like it's like this insecure jealousy that gets you nothing. It means nothing. Like somebody's success does not mean your failure. Like you're totally in competition with yourself. Because I'm telling you, if you're funny and like undeniably funny, some people will use you. There's no like guy sitting home who's the funniest man on the planet that nobody wants to use,
right.
Unless he's the biggest dickhead in the world. I mean, there's that possibility too.
Yeah. All right. I mean.
And there was
advice.
Yeah, don't be a dick. Like you know, just don't be a dick. Let me tell you something. You're gonna get more work from comics than any booker. And that's why you got to be cool. Like in network, you shit talk. It's a small community. I've seen it. People are like, how come so and so don't book me? Because you're a fucking piece of shit. Like yeah, you're funny, but you're an asshole.
Yeah, I'm finding one of the most beneficial things for me is I've been able to write with two guys, and we found like a little, you know, a little group, and it's great because we're very honest with each other, and it just really helps like flush things out and edit things, like things that make sense in my head completely. When I tell them, and someone goes, "What are you going for there?" Or, like, I don't understand it. It helps so much, like having someone to write with or to go over things with, and even if. Like a person's way ahead of you, sometimes it's nice to hear their stuff and be able to comment on it. Like, oh, I didn't get that. Or it really helps a lot.
Yeah, it's good to be around people that are better than you because it makes you step up your game. Like, you never want to be the best comic in your circle.
Right.
Like, a lot of, like, I hang around with really funny guys that, like, make me, like, I want to be that.
Yeah,
I think it like pushes me. You know what I mean? Not that I don't hang. It's not like, hey, you're not funny enough for me to hang out with you. I'm not like that. Like I try to keep around people that have the drive I have, that want to be better, that don't talk shit. I mean, it's a community.
Yeah,
and it's you got. I don't know, man. It's like just do it. And if you like it, keep doing it. Okay. That's like the easiest thing.
All right. I want to get into a couple interesting news stories here. First one is a flight attendant warns travelers to flush their drugs before landing.
That's a great flight attendant.
Sometimes I like to pick the news stories depending on the guest.
Yeah.
So I found this one for you. And the next one I have for you kind of too. This was in Australia. An Australian airline apologized on Wednesday, because everyone apologizes now. But for a warning a flight attendant gave passengers who might have been flying high that there were drug-sniffing dogs awaiting at the Sydney airport. Many of the 210 passengers aboard the Jetstar flight from Gold Coast City had attended the Splendor in the Grass weekend music festival at Byron Bay and were returning home. We have been told there are sniffer dogs and quarantine officers waiting in the domestic terminal. If you need to dispose of anything you shouldn't have, we suggest you flush it now, he added. the crew, and of course the airline, saying the crew members' words were poorly chosen and are plainly at odds with the professional standards we'd expect from our team. We apologize to customers offended by the comment. But it does say a lot of people, it prompted many passengers to rush to the toilets. What do you think about that? Hero or?
Hero. Because it's like.
That's great.
First off, why are people traveling with. I mean, how you're in America. I mean, I don't know what type of drug addicts these were on this plane, but like. When you're into drugs, I wouldn't travel. It's so easy to find them in city to city.
Haven't people seen Locked Up Abroad like that?
This is international flights?
This is Australia.
Oh, yeah, you're crazy to be flying internationally with drugs. You're crazy to, you know. But that's great that they warned them. But doesn't...
Wouldn't
there be a big cake of drugs in the toilet on the plane? It doesn't go into the sky. Yeah. It doesn't. It's not like a boat where
guys on the ground like, oh.
Yeah,
thank
I mean,
God.
Like, yeah, isn't this plane going to get, like, won't the drugs be built up? And then I'd be like, okay, seat 13 went.
I guess the point is maybe. You know, I guess there's no cameras, and I guess they couldn't prove that.
Yeah,
you
there's no cameras,
it.
But why? I guess it's bad PR for the flight to be like. That's just a weird scenario, though.
It's
like,
really weird.
But I think that person's a hero because she's looking out for fellow men.
That's what I mean. Because
it's just drugs. Now, if you said like, if you have a murder weapon on here,
please flush
and
a machine
don't
get gun.
If you committed a murder before flying and have the weapon on this plane, we have. FBI agents waiting
for
you.
I have no problem with it. It's almost just like, hey, you know, I don't want to see you guys get, you know, royally fucked the rest of your life, you know? Like,
right, you know? Right, yeah.
But, I mean, you can understand as the company, too, like, I mean, I guess that's not the attendant's place to do that, but I mean, I have no problem with it. If I was carrying drugs and someone told me, hey, flush that shit, this fucking dog.
Yeah, maybe she should that off the side of the mouth with the mouth open. I want you to fuck her. I'm just saying, I know you're fucked up right now. Once you're in the bathroom.
So that's that. I found that one interesting. Next one is, I wanted to bring this up. I'll tell you in a minute. It's woman dies during a Juggalo event. Now.
That the insane clown posse?
The insane clown posse.
I served them pancakes one time.
I can't even go into the story. You gotta, you have to explain that first.
Right now?
Yes.
Well, it's not that exciting. I worked at IHOP in East Brunswick, New Jersey, when I was in college, and they were playing it was the Birch Hill nightclub back then.
Yeah.
And I used to meet a lot of musicians. Used to always have their tour buses in that parking lot because it was like a hotel right there.
Right.
And I saw the Insane Clown Posse bus with their pictures on it. And then, but they weren't in there in makeup.
I was just gonna say
they were not in makeup. I didn't know they were Insane Clown Posse, but they had. I was at their table, and then someone told me it was the Insane Clown Posse, and I'm like, "Wow!" I served them pancakes, and then they gave me free tickets to the show that night, and then I sold them to somebody else.
I'm just like picturing like two of them in like clown makeup eating
no.
a short.
No,
stack.
Then I would have known it was
eating
them.
A short stack.
No, if they were, but
a woman dies during the Juggalo event. Now the Juggalos. They have their annual gathering every year, which is like a huge
like a festival. Yeah, I heard about it.
So, family members told the Tisosi was her name, Crystal Tisosi of Flint, Michigan, died Sunday at the Juggalo, the gathering of the Juggalo. It said she did not drink any alcohol or take any non-prescribed drugs. The gathering of the Juggalos took place this weekend. The Juggalos, fans of the Insane Clown Posse, who are known for their large gatherings, have been labeled as a loosely organized hybrid gang by the FBI now. The reason I wanted to bring this up, apparently the Juggalos, it's quite an event. You could they spray each other with Faygo soda.
What's Faygo soda?
Some soda from like the 90s. Apparently they have people hanging from their piercings. Some guy lost a nipple. Charlie Murphy was there and Jim Norton. I think this was last year though. But what I wanted to bring this up because I know you told me a story back in the day that you went to Woodstock.
Yeah. Woodstock 94.
Woodstock 94. Yeah. And I was thinking about like these big, there's so many of these festivals now, like Firefly and Bonnaroo, and there's so many of them now. I don't think I could ever do it anymore. Like I go to a concert and I could barely make it to the band that, like if there's an opener, I'm like, oh, I got to sit through this shit. And like, and I'm tired by the end. Like,
I'm no longer standing at concerts no more. I'm getting a seat.
Yeah,
that.
But I could never do this. I used to do like the Warp Tour all the time, and like be down in Asbury Park, and it was 900 degrees, and there'd be 50 bands I wanted to see. Now it's like it's disgusting. Like
because you're getting old, man.
It's amazing. Like these festivals are humongous now. Like it's almost like Europe was known for these humongous music festivals for a long time, and now it's like I think it's making its way over to the United States. But I wanted to hear your account of Woodstock 94 because it's awesome.
Oh, man. I'll tell you, just a side note, because we were talking about being old, going to concerts, and I just recently saw Colin Quinn's one-man show.
Oh, you saw that?
Unconstitutional at the Newton Theater. He's talking about Bruce Springsteen in the section. He goes, "Are you really for the working man, Bruce, having a four-hour concert on Tuesday?" That's... I mean, I just always thought that was a great observation. But
how was it? I heard it was great.
His show was great. Yeah, I really liked it. I'm glad it was local too. But I didn't have to go far to see it.
Because it was on Broadway, right?
But
or it was in the city for a
yeah,
while.
Yeah, yeah. I think he toured with it. Yeah.
So
Woodstock. 94. Jeez, I haven't talked about that in a long time. That was during my last relapse. I was well back on drugs then after that. First rehab step.
So 94, what age are you? Are we talking here?
I'm a year out of high school, so I'm 18.
Okay.
I'm 18. Yeah, I got clean in 95, so it's like 6 months after Woodstock I got clean again. But, I don't know. I wasn't going to go, then I was listening. I was like working for like a parks department in my hometown and heard on the radio, they're broken down the fences at Woodstock. It was like the day, it didn't even really start yet. People were just going in. So I called my brother. I call my brother. I'm like, "Yeah, you want to go?" And my buddy Billy, and we went. We just got in the car and we drove. But we get up there.
Did you have tickets?
No, we just were like, "We're gonna go in."
Yep.
And if we don't go in, we'll just drive home. Like, you know, when you're 18, you can do shit like that. You can drive 4 hours to do shit like that. We drive up there and they close off all exits to the town. So we're like sitting at like some Cumberland Farms. Like, you know, what are we gonna do? You know, just go home. So some drunk cab driver pulls up. He goes, "You guys want to go to Woodstock?" We're like, "Yeah."
Yes,
he's like, "I'll take you. I know some back roads through the woods." This is shit you do when you're 18 because you're like, "What could happen?"
Now, this is exactly why I wanted to talk about this.
So first off, I'm like, "What am I going to do with my car?" You know,
natural.
My Hyundai Excel that I bought for $2,000. I can't afford to lose that. You know, but that I crashed while high already. But that was a weird story. I was driving. I smoked this real small joint. And I'm thinking, you know, like when someone's making a left, you're like, "Oh, I'm going to go around them on the right." So I do that. And the guy makes a right and just takes me with him, this big van. And it was like a Board of Education vehicle, like right in front of a school. I'm like, "Oh, my God." Cops come. They're like, "What happened?" I'm like, "His blinker didn't work." That was the only thing I could think of. His blinker wasn't working. So, his stoplights weren't working, so I had to swerve from hitting him. Then he turned. So he goes, "Go turn on, go hit your brakes, sir." And they glue, like, perfect. I was like, I swear to God. It's the worst performance I ever had. But anyway, he didn't arrest me.
Worse than the Gotham performance?
Yeah. Both equal. No. Gotham was worse. This one, I got away with it. So we this cab driver, I just trust him to leave my car at his apartment complex.
Oh, my God.
Drives through the woods. We roll up joints to smoke with him. He's drinking a beer. We get pulled over. A cop appears, like, on this dirt road. He's driving us down, and the lights go on. And he goes to throw his beer out the window, and the window is closed. But
did it smash all over the place?
No, it just kind of, like, dink-dink, and then, like, kind of spilt on him. It didn't smash.
Oh, my God.
But we're just smoking pot, and it's like, we're dead. Yeah. Like, but I don't know if it's like upstate New York thing. Like, the cops are a little bit more lax.
Yeah.
I don't know how to got.
Nowadays, you'd be in the back of the car in 2 seconds.
I can't recall what happened as far as his conversation with the police officer, this cab driver. But whatever, we pulled away. And we get there, and there's just a million people going in. I have my Marlboro tent that I got from Marlboro Miles. Remember Marlboro Miles?
My wife
used to smoke cigarettes and collect them, and then get like kayaks and tents.
My wife like signed up for that when she was like 17, and she still gets like random Marlboro pack, like darts and like.
It's great.
It's awesome.
Yeah, you know, little payback for the cancerous lungs, right?
Yeah, I may have lung cancer, but I got a kayak.
I got a kayak to work that cancer out of my lungs. I was going for the pool table. That was like so many packs. You needed like really. But we used to be like homeless people with that. Like you'd see like a Marlboro pack like in a garbage can, be like, get the miles. Like rummage.
Would you have to like register them or something? Like or send them in or something?
Well, there was no internet really then. Yeah. So I think we sent them in and just trusted. Like they had a catalog.
Like the old like on the cereal boxes. Remember when you had to cut out things to get a prize?
Yeah, remember we used to sell candy at school? You had the catalog. Like if you sell this much candy, you can get a bike. It was like that, but with cigarettes. Very weird.
Nicotine fundraiser.
Yeah, you're like, you had goals. It gave you something to smoke for.
I gotta get that. I gotta get that 10 speed.
Joe, you've become like such a chain smoker. We're trying to get a pool table for my mom's basement. I'm doing 4 packs a day now. That's when cigarettes were $2 a pack. It was very easy to kill yourself. Very cheap. But so we get to Woodstock, me, my brother, Billy, and we're like, I know a bunch of my friends bought tickets and we're going to be there. And when you're like, I'm never going to find these people. So we see the main stage. Now, it wasn't fully packed, just a lot of people. We set up our tent, go to sleep. Wake up the first day. I feel like somebody's stepping on me in my tent. Like, I feel like somebody, I'm like, who's stepping on me? And me and my brother pop our heads out of the Marlboro tent, and there's 400,000 people around us. It's very hard to take apart a tent amongst a crowd like that. So we just kind of grabbed it, and we're carrying like a half-built tent through a crowd. So we're like, let's go up on that hill. And we go up, and we see my friend Mark at the time had dyed his hair orange, and all I hear, and mind you, like, I'm really high.
Yeah.
Really high,
well,
and I just hear,
of course.
Fernandez! I just see an orange head waving at me. I'm like, I couldn't believe I found my friend. And we put up this campsite. It was the weirdest thing, Woodstock, because we're just taking acid, smoking pot. It was almost a community. Like, we had roads. Like, we knew where to go get opium.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, you gotta go. There's the guy with the skull and crossbones flag. Walk towards that and then look for the dude who's got the big fish thing set up.
I've heard
people
like, I have a friend who went to Bonner. He says just like that, like they establish like a little community.
Yeah, a little community. Well, yeah. I mean, a guy came by. He's like, guys want to smoke opium? We're like, yeah, sure. You're like, yeah, that's a rational decision. Why not? Strange guy walks up, offers you something. Just getting high. We saw a path of people walking to a local grocery store. We bought them out of all their food. It's mudslides, high. Every band I was into in the 90s,
Boobs
Blind
everywhere.
Melon. But I don't know. Like I say, like I never want to do drugs again. But if you could promise me I can live that weekend again, I'll do them. Because it was one of the best. I mean, how can you beat that? You're 18 years old. You've got access to all the quality hallucinogens you could want. and all your favorite bands that you currently listen to are playing there. You're like,
do you remember like a key act? Like what was your favorite, or it was all blur?
Well, Blind, I loved Blind Melon back then. They were amazing. I got
that first
one
album.
Of the weirdest things were Mudslide. Now at the time, this was 94. Nine Inch Nails was known, but they weren't mainstream.
Right.
And we're mudsliding close to the main stage. We're mudsliding with these dudes.
You also have to see Joe's hand.
Yeah, I'm motioning a mudslide. Like we're going down a hill. Like my hand starts up in my head and then goes towards my feet in case he doesn't know what sliding means. I'm bringing it down.
And so, he's consistently doing it in waves.
Consistently doing it in waves to, you know, draw a picture. So we're these group of guys we're mudsliding with. And this is like, you didn't see my Nine Inch Nails like in TV. I didn't know what they looked like. So this group of guys with headsets on come grab these guys from our mudslide. And now they're on stage playing Terrible Lies. And I'm like, we were just mudsliding with Nine Inch Nails. We had no idea. It was one of those weekends where shit was just happening and you're high and you're like, is this happening or am I just really high?
Yeah.
And so I got to see Nine Inch Nails, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blind Melon, Metallica. Ugh,
awesome.
Everybody, man. I think Primus was there. I don't know. If you're 18, you should have this a weekend where all your favorite bands are.
Yeah.
And just have a party like that. Like it's like, I'm sorry if this is like, it's very long ago I did this, so the recall is not too good on. I probably had better stories about it back then because it was fresh.
Yeah.
But like, you know.
So Woodstock ends. How do you get your
car? Oh, that's interesting because we don't know how to get out of there. I do. So if you bought a ticket back then, you had a bus to and from like Fairleigh Dickinson. So there was no way to really check people for who they really were. So we saw the buses. So. They have like a list or like Steve Schwartzstein. I'm like, yeah, that's me. And I would just get on the bus. So me and my brother and my buddy Billy get on this bus under fake people's names and get driven to Fairleigh Dickinson.
Those three people are standing in the field like, shit.
I think they just got to the point they gave up. They're just letting people like go. We get there, get my friend Doughboy to come pick us up in his pickup truck.
Doughboy.
He's fat. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't picturing a real skinny.
He introduced himself that way to me, so I just, you know, it's not like I saw a fat kid and say, you are now Doughboy. But so he drove us back. I knew how to get to the Cumberland Farms. I knew how to get to the guy's house from the Cumberland Farms. So we get to the guy's house, the taxi driver. He goes, he just comes out all fucking way. He's like, I never thought I'd see you again. And I get my car. So my buddy, who didn't come with us, Doughboy, says, it's not far to get to this, to where it was. So we drive back to where Woodstock was just to show him. We walked out in the main stage just empty. Like, it was really cool.
Surreal.
Just a muddy field. The stage is empty. There's still, like, some people, like, with these little campsites here and there.
We ain't leaving.
And we're walking. And we're by a pot, it was like a ripped up pillow. You know, like somebody ripped a pillow and there's cotton all over. We see this hippie guy come up. He goes, hey, man, I hear the Pearl Jam's playing in Bethel, which is where the original Woodstock was. You guys go? And we're like, nah, man, we're music festivaled out. He goes, dude, you guys got cotton? And there's just the ball. It's not our cotton. And he takes it, puts balls in between all his toes and walks off. We're like, all right. And, right. So,
you got cotton?
Dude, you got cotton? So then we find a cat. Back then, you know, it was all those little disposable cameras, those cardboard ones.
Oh,
there's no cell phones and shit. I had one that I lost in my drunken, tripping haze that weekend. Find a camera. This is total truth, I swear. Find a camera in the mud. So we're like, we're going to take it. I mean, people, obviously, I've set it up poorly. They're going to know what I'm about to say. But we're thinking maybe some good nude pictures on here, some freaky pictures. We develop it. It's my fucking camera.
What are the odds of that, man?
What are the odds? I come back and find it in the mud. And it's my camera with pictures of my friends on it.
And you got home safely.
No, we got home safely. And I came home with somebody else's clothes on. I didn't have my clothes on. I had like a... because it wasn't my style That's how I knew. Because I had like a pair of like Jenko jeans on somehow. I don't know. Like, I was more of a metalhead. My mom's like, what's with these pants? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I'm just.
I don't know. Leave me alone.
I don't know.
Woodstock 94.
So, yeah, there's a. Yeah, so. No, was, speaking of festivals, Jimmy Kimmel does one of those favorite. He goes to that Coachella one.
Mm-hmm.
He asked them. He asked fake band names.
That's the best.
Oh, people,
that's the best.
You
I've
like
seen that.
You like Bacon Hammer? They're like,
oh, they're good, but not.
They like a lot of their older stuff.
Yeah, they
oh,
did that
so funny.
South by Southwest too. Like people like, oh yeah, their new stuff's pretty good. They're cutting edge. Blah blah blah.
I think he calls it lie witness news.
Yeah. All right. Well, I had one more, but we're getting kind of late in the podcast here.
What was the one more?
All right. Here we go.
We'll decide whether I'll answer it by then.
Well, this is I always do a segment most of the time called Dirtbag of the Week.
Dirtbag of the Week.
Dirtbag of the Week.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you pick one?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. I don't know if you're going to make me pick one. I'm like, why not? It's a tall order.
No. This is him. So the headline is T-neck man, T-neck, New Jersey, pulled gun on neighbor for farting. An elderly man was arrested Monday night after a neighbor's fart allegedly drove him to threaten him with a gun, police said. Daniel Collins, 72, had been involved in an ongoing dispute with the unidentified neighbor for some time, Detective blah 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 said. The neighbor told officers that Collins pointed a revolver at him in the vestibule of their apartment building. Collins said he confronted the man after hearing him pass gas in front of his apartment door, but denied threatening him with a gun. He consented to a search, and officers recovered a .32 caliber revolver from his vehicle. Imagine being... If people pulled guns on people for farting, I'd be dead many years ago.
Oh, yeah. It's got to be... The relationship has to be longer than that. I got to believe this isn't the first time they met. There has to be neighbors where they've had problems before, and that was the last straw.
Or fart history. Like, he crop dusted them daily. You know,
yeah, there has to be more to that story. It can't be like I just moved in. I walking past my neighbor's house. I had, you know, I had a lot of arugula that day, so I'm gassy.
So, yep, that is my dirt bag of the week.
The guy who farted, or the guy who pulled
the
gun.
No, the guy who pulled the gun on the fart.
I mean, you don't know how bad the fart was.
I mean, if it was that bad, I mean, I've
had someone yell at me on a plane one time. Not yell at me. She just goes, "Enough already."
I'm picturing this story coming out in a couple of years with my wife pulling a gun on me
for farting.
For farting, because she's like, "I'm going to kill you." Like,
well, if that was her defense in court after killing you, listen, he farted. She's got to be telling the truth. No one would pull that.
It had to be that bad.
But that's your dirt bag of the week.
That's my dirt bag of the week.
We didn't shoot him, so he's not that bad. We got to give the guy some credit. He really just...
He just threatened
I think there's more to the story. I can't really call that guy a dirt bag yet.
Half a dirt bag.
Yeah.
But anyway, Joe, thank you for coming on. That was a great... It was pretty fun.
Pretty fun, yeah.
I mean, we talked about a little comedy, talked about the Juggalos, talked about narcotics.
You made me go back into the depths of my brain from 1994.
Yeah.
Which was the biggest drug year of my career.
Joe, anything you want to plug? You got your website, obviously.
Yeah, I got my website, joefernandez.net.
With an S.
Yeah, Fernandez with an S. That's where you can see all my dates where I perform live. Find me on Facebook. That's where I like to... post a lot of jokes on Facebook. That's just what I use it for. If I have a weird thought, I don't know if I want to put it on stage, I'll put it on Facebook. So find me on Facebook. When people like my shit, it makes me feel good about myself.
Exactly. If I'm doing good on Facebook, I'm doing good in real life.
That's how I measure.
All right, so check out joefernandez.net, check out his podcast, and go see him live if possible.
When's this coming out? I have a headline date.
I'll probably
September.
Get it up either tonight or tomorrow.
Okay, well, there's a you know, I'm just starting to headline, so I have one in September in East Rutherford at Paisano's.
Paisano's, right now, up your alley, buddy.
No, but it's run by the Comedy Shop. Let me tell you something. it's a great room for comedy. They've been doing comedy there for about a year and a half. They do it once a month. Every show's been sold out.
That's awesome.
So go there, because I'd like, and I'll be curious to know if anyone listening to this comes there. So say, hey man, I heard you on Scott's podcast.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm gonna let Scott know how many people. I'm gonna let Scott know how many friend requests I got.
Oh,
so he says he has 20 listeners. I expect at least
one,
10, at least 10 Facebook requests.
You're gonna see me post. Please go friend Joe for next.
No private messaging. If Scott private messages you, don't friend me. I want it natural from the podcast.
Well, anyway, I'll be at Tierney's again on August 17th, and Mara's in South Amboy on the 22nd.
Look at you, Scott, getting the gigs, man. I'm proud of you, bro. Scott's been talking about doing comedy for years, and he's finally getting off his ass.
100% committed.
Oh, subscribe to my podcast, too. I'm going to start it again.
He will start it again, and maybe I'll get to go on it again.
Yes. We'll see how many I get from this podcast.
Anyway, Joe, thanks again for joining me. Everybody, keep the wind at your back, and I love you.